Goodbye. All right, I think we read through Perek Tet last week, correct? I don't know if we got any further, but we read through the Perek. It's my little. I have to have my map. I don't think we'll ever use it, but I have to have my. It's my little. My security blanket.
That was blown away.
All right. So we went through the parak last week, I believe, and we started discussion or started talking about the givonim and the dialogue, the ruse that they created to come to Bnei Israel and to come to Bnei Israel to offer a brit with them, and so basically let's start from the beginning for a moment. The Givonim are a nation from amongst the Amei Canaan, one of the seven nations of Canaan, in fact descended from the Chivi. And we know that there is an issue with regards to the war with the nations of Canaan, the status of the nations of Canaan. They come to Bnei Israel, and they pretend that they are in fact not from Amei Canaan, but that they are from a faraway land, and therefore Bnei Israel are duped or tricked into making some sort of a brit with them, only to discover 3 days later that in fact they are from the region, they are from the local area, from the area just north of Yerushalayim. Excuse me?
Are they from Givon?
They're from Givon, which is north of where today Kiryat Tozdon is.
Exactly.
That's right. That's exactly where they're from. And of course, it doesn't take them months and months to get to Gilgal from where they are, but that is all part of their ruse. And when they discover them, they're faced with the dilemma of whether or not to kill them. They decide not to kill them because of the brit that they had made with them, and the result of which was that they made them, designated them as Chotvei Eitzim V'Shoavei Mayim, wood choppers and water carriers. And the Givonim become a story that carries with us for generations. At the end of the unit, we'll talk a little bit about where the Givonim end up in the rest of biblical history, because we find them in a number of chapters and a number of instances, and the issue of the future of what happens to the Givonim is an interesting discussion. But of course, everything revolves in this parak, everything revolves around the question of what is the relationship between Israel and the Amei Canaan? What is the legal framework by which the conquest of Canaan was taking place? And did, in fact, the Givonim need to engage in this ruse if they were truly interested in survival? Was there alternative options? Did they know of alternative options? What exactly was the legal basis of the need for the Givonim to come to Yehoshua and to conduct this ruse? That's the first question. The second question is, once they do come, Bnei Israel, and they engage Israel in this kind of dialogue, what is Israel's response? What is their status? What should they have done? Could they have done? Did they do what was right? So we're going to divide this discussion up into two parts. One is the perspective, if you will, of the Givonim, the motivation of the Givonim, and the second being the response of Bnei Israel and then the various leadership roles that different parts of Bnei Israel play in this parak, specifically Yehoshua, the Nesiim, the Edah, the various levels of leadership that are expressed here, and we have to look at all of them. That's sort of where we left off at the end of last week, correct? Yes? No?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, good. So let's start with the question of the brit. was what was required, what was necessary, what was the Givonim go to get to great lengths to defend themselves or to essentially find some mechanism for survival by suggesting that they are not from a Meknan, that they are actually from a faraway land, and the assumption is that the reason they did that was because from their perspective they assumed that every nation in the region of Canaan itself was essentially going to be faced with the destruction as Israel comes marching through the land. The basis of that is two paragraphs in Sefer Dvarim, and in fact the Givonim articulate that. They say explicitly at the end of the perek, when they're challenged by Yoshua, why did you do this, etc., so they say at the end of Perek Tet, Ki hugad hugad la'avadecha at asher tziva Hashem elkecha et Moshe avdo. It was told to us that which God has commanded to Moshe his servant, latet lechem et kol ha'aretz, to give you the entire land, ulahashmid et kol yoshvei ha'aretz mipnechem, and to destroy all the inhabitants of the land from before you. Vanira ma'od nafshoteinu, and we were frightened for our lives. V'naset ha'davar hazeh, so that's why we did this. So from the perspective of the Givonim, at the end, they're very open about what their motivation was. They understood that they were slated, together with the rest of the Amekanan, for destruction. And it was a function of either running away, or giving up, or finding some way to bypass this law that every nation in Canaan is going to be destroyed. And the only way they could do that was to disguise themselves as... And so clearly from their perspective, they are slated for destruction together with the rest of the Amekanan. And therefore, they have no choice but to assume that they are not from the Amekanan, from some faraway land, and that's why they disguise themselves. The basis of that appears in two paragraphs in Sefer Dvarim, and I want to take a look at them because the halachic context here is very important. We discussed this a little bit when we started at the beginning of last year. We discussed a little bit about what, in fact, was the command, the instruction vis-a-vis the conquest of Canaan. But it's since it's so relevant to this parak, we're going to do a quick review. So let's start from Devarim Parak Zion. We'll start with the beginning of Perek Zion. Perek Zion, Pasuk Aleph, Dvarim. Ki yevi'echa Hashem alakecha el ha'aretz asher ata basham alevishta. You will cross over to the land when you've got that God will give you his inheritance. V'nashal goyim rabim mipanecha. God will remove or conquer great nations before you. Hachiti, v'agigashi, v'hemori, v'aknani, v'apizi, v'achivi, v'ahibusi. One of the only places where all seven are mentioned. Shiva'a goyim rabim v'atzumim mimeka. Seven nations greater and stronger than you. U'netanam Hashem alakecha lefanecha v'ikitam. God will give them over into your hands. You will smite them. Hacharem tacharim otam. You will surely destroy them. Lo tichrot lahem brit, velo tachanim. You may not make a pact, a covenant, an agreement with them. You may not grant them tachanim. Excuse me. How does it translate tachanim? Yeah. But it has a certain legal connotation.
It says, nor show any mercy to them.
That's not
favor,
mercy. All right. It's not like the Lotachanim has a halachic connotation. The term for it in English, and I forget what it is. So, you shall not show favor to them or have mercy upon them. Lotitchaten bam, shall not marry them. You can't marry the daughters or the sons. Why? Because they will lead you astray, and they will lead you to other gods and to other deities. And God will be angry at you and destroy you. One of the few places in the Chumash where you have an explicit reference to the notion of intermarriage, which is not a discussion right now, but the prohibition here is very clear. Lo tichot lahem brit. You may not make a brit with the local population. And that's specifically with regards to which peoples?
The one that's not mentioned sometimes is
Girgashi.
And there is a tradition that Girgashi runs away.
And that's why they're mentioned sometimes, but not in other places. The only one that's sort of the odd man out, if you will, is Girgashi.
So the first prohibition, in other words, when Yeshua comes into the land of Israel, he sends
a message, and one of the people, that you can either stay and fight or you can leave. So Girgashi supposedly leaves, because we don't have any explicit reference to it, but there's a Mesoret and Chazal that Girgashi took the high road, if you will, to Tripoli. He just left.
Took the road.
The highway, one of those, it's called the highway. That's the first prohibition. Lo tichot lahem brit. And clearly, if the Givonim show up and say, quote lanu brit, we want a brit with you, and we knew that they were chivi, then the question becomes, are they in violation of this prohibition? And that, from the Givonim's perspective, they assume they would be, and therefore they need to go through this entire ruse, because otherwise Israel would refuse a brit with them on the basis of this prohibition. And the fact that they make reference to it, they say, we know that God commanded Moshe, etc., you shall not make a brit with them, means that this was not a secret. This was very public information.
They were very learned.
Well, I think it was public information. I think it was stated explicitly, and it was very public, and they knew that that was the basis of the conquest. I don't think they were particularly learned. I think they were just well aware of what was well publicized. That's issue number one. Issue number two is Dvarim Parak Chaf. And this section we actually, well, both sections we actually saw, but we're going to. Parak Chaf Pasuk Yud. Dvarim. Ki tikrav el ir lihilachem alea v'krata alea l'shalom. When you approach a city to wage war against it, you shall extend first a call of peace. V'haya im shalom ta'ancha ufatcha lach. If they will answer you in peace, if they will engage, they will respond in peace. V'haya kol ha'am nimtza bayu lach alamas v'avaducha. Then the people have to accept your authority. They will pay taxes to you. They will serve you. In other words, they have to be willing to accept your sovereignty. Essentially, there's a great deal of discussion about what this Masra Vaducha means, but the simplest explanation is that the one level of understanding, which is a literal level, which is that you will make them your servants, which is to an extent what we ended up doing with the Givonim. We made them some kind of servant status to the Mishnah. The intent of the verse was in the context of sovereignty. In other words, if you are the sovereign ruling power in the land, and the group of people want to stay there or want to live in that territory, they can do so, but they have to be willing to pay the same tribute and the same mass and the same service to the sovereign entity, which in this case is yourselves, as anybody else. which, by the way, includes a ban on idolatry and an acceptance of the seven mitzvot, and that's where the concept of a ger toshav comes in. V'im lo tashlimimach, v'astayim cha mechama, if they won't make peace with you, and therefore the alternative, which is war, v'tzartale, you shall besiege it, God will give them into your hands, you will kill all the males, the combatants, but the women and the children and everybody else you can't touch, that they're not part of the fighting force. This we discussed when we discussed the morality of the conquest of Canaan last year. Skip down to Pasuk Tet Vav. Kein ta'ase l'chol ha'arim ha'rechokot mimcha me'od. Thus you shall do to all of the faraway nations, faraway cities, not from the seven nations of Canaan. But from these nations which God will give you as an inheritance here in the land of Canaan, you shall destroy them, you shall not let them live. And of course here Girgashi is missing, and as I said, that's based on the tradition that Girgashi runs away. So we have this second place where we have the requirement of Hachamim and Lod Techaya called. You put these three phrases together. Lo tichot lahem brit, hachamim tachamimem, lo techaya kol neshama. And you get the impression that there were really no options here. Any one of the seven nations that were left in the land of Canaan really had no choice but to either leave or fight to the end. But there was no middle ground. That's at least the perception that we get when we read the psukim face value. And from that point of view, I understand where the givonim are coming from. The givonim assuming that they knew these public declarations, and they make it very clear that they did know them, then they perceive that there was really no other alternative but to disguise themselves as one of the faraway nations which have a different status. If they're not from the nations of Canaan, then they don't fall into the category of hacharem tacharimem ola tachaya kol neshama. They fall into the option of peacemaking, number one. And number two, they do not fall into the prohibition of lo tichot lahem brit. That from the perspective of the givonim. From a halachic perspective, however, this is not so simple. And that is where we are going to start our discussion. Let's take a look at the sources. Take a look at let's start with source number two. The Machloket Rashi and the Rambam. Rashi on the one hand, Ramban and the Rambam on the other. In terms of how to understand this prohibition, just again, the phrase, the sources here, this is Dvarim Perek Zion, and this is Dvarim Perek Chaf. There's two different issues here. So with regards to the second set of issues, Hacharim Tacharim Lo Tachayek Kol Neshama, or the flip side of it, which is the requirement of offering peace, the requirement first to extend a hand in peace, to whom does that apply? So when we read the psukim, I'm going to do a quick review of what we did last year. When we read the psukim initially, if you read them on the face of it, it sounds like the Karat Eleh L'Shalom is an option for faraway nations. Thus you shall do for nations who live far away, not from the nations of Canaan, but from these nations of the land which I will give you. Ki'acharem tacharimem lo tachayek kol neshama, you shall not let them live, you shall utterly destroy them. It sounds as if there's no option for peacemaking of any kind. At that, halacha is not the position of the majority of the Rishonim, nor of the conclusion of the Gemara. Rashi on the Pasuk interprets it in exactly that fashion. Rashi says, Pasuk Yud, Ki tikrav al yirli lechem alev, v'karat alev l'shalom. This phrase here. Rashi says, V'melchemet harashut ha-katub medaber, that offer of peace is talking about the optional category of battle, namely battles with nations that live far away. Kemo shemefurash b'inyan, ken taseh l'chol ha'arim ha-rechokot. And if I look at it from that perspective, then there really isn't any other option. Then the nations of Canaan are essentially slated for either leaving or destruction, and the Givonim had no alternative, from their perspective, but to disguise themselves as outsiders. And then their ruse made sense. The Brit was done. And we'll have to address the question of whether or not the Brit is valid if it's made under false pretense. But that certainly would be the perspective of the Gibbon. On the other hand, both the Ramban and the Rambam, and really the halachic conclusion of the Gemara at length, is not that simple. And the way the Ramban reads it is as follows. Aval, aval kriyat shalom afilu b'melchemet mitzvahi. Says the Ramban, this requirement of a kriyat alel l'shalom applies even to a melchemet mitzvah. Shechayavim likro l'shalom afilu l'shiva amamim. We are obligated to extend the option of peace even to the seven nations of Canaan. And the proof of it is, Shehrei Moshe kriyat l'shalom l'sichon melachem mori. Moshe himself first asked Sichon, king of Amori, to offer them, to extend a hand of peace, to let them pass through their land. Sichon was also one of the seven nations of Canaan. Certainly nobody's going to assume that Moshe Rabbeinu himself was violation of these two prohibitions when he offered Sichon, when he asked for Sichon to save passage and peaceful resolution to the conflict. Aval hefresh shebenehem kasher lo tashlim ve'astan milchama shetziva katuv b'rechokot lahakot et kol zuchuna ulachayot lahem hanashim ve'ataf ve'zucharim ubarei ha'amim ha'el etziva lacharim gam hanashim ve'ataf.
In other words, the way you read the psukim is that the Karat Alel L'Shalom applies to both, everybody. Both Shiva Amamim and, let's call it, he calls it Mechamet Rishut, essentially non-Canaanite nations. You have to extend the hand of peace to both. If they make peace with you, so then the Pasuk says, V'tzart Alel. You will besiege the city, which, as we explained, the purpose of a siege is to take captives, to take the population alive, and to transform the population into servants and slaves, etc. Whereas with Amei Canaan, the purpose of the battle is not to take captives, because you cannot allow the Canaanite, idolatrous, pagan, immoral culture to remain active in the land. And therefore, if after the Karat Alel L'Shalom, the Amei Canaan refuse and they wage war, then you're waging a different kind of war. What the Torah calls Lo Techayeh Kol Neshama. That's not a war of siege. That's a frontal attack. That's a direct conflict whose goal it is to establish sovereignty, control, power, and a moral code that would operate in that region, create an idolatry-free zone in the land. But if I read the text this way, the offer of peace is an option even for the Amei Canaan, provided they accept two or three conditions. Condition number one, Jewish sovereignty. Condition number two,
the most important. They have to abandon the pagan idolatrous culture that has been operational in this land for generations, which includes child sacrifice, which includes virgin rape, which includes all of the immoral practices that were so much part of the idolatrous culture. We talked about that last year. It's a very important component to understand why the Torah was so insistent that this culture eradication was worth engaging in, even by the sword. The Torah describes idolatry not as theologically offensive, but as morally offensive.
That is so not clear to people. I mean, I think that's a really good point, because we were having sort of a discussion about this in the Rav's class last week, and it just really, no one explains it from that point of view. It's always, you know, well, they have this belief, and they have this
right.
one.
Because we look at it from a 20th century, 21st century, you know, liberal, everybody's entitled to their, right? But wars in the 21st century have been fought over civil rights and morality. The fact is that when you look at the issues that the Torah raises, every time it raises the issue of idolatry, lo titen et bincha lemolech, right? It's child sacrifice. It's, when you look at the Nevi'im, what they fought against were these practices that were that included murder, rape, abuse, and they were morally offensive together with everything else. There's no way around that. You can't possibly comprehend the intensity of the Torah's battle against idolatry with on purely theological terms. Well, they're all intermingled, they're all interconnected, because religious beliefs or cultures are connected to nations. Every nation has their own deity, has their own god, and therefore their own way of service, so they're all interconnected in the biblical arena, certainly. And that's why you have to establish sovereignty in order to eradicate the culture, because every nation, every sovereign nation is entitled to their own deity and therefore their own gods. And with that comes their own culture and everything else. And the Torah's prohibition is to, and the Torah's command is not only to remove, not only to prohibit you from engaging in the culture, but from literally eradicating the culture you're not allowed to tolerate in your midst. It would essentially be the modern equivalent, if I could use this one example, of the Western civilization's ban on female circumcision. Right? That is imposing a religious value over another society. Somebody can come along and say, in the name of religious belief, we are going to practice this because that's part of our culture. And you're going to say, not in my country, you are not going to do that because we consider it morally offensive. And so we will pass laws and ban practices that we consider to be morally offensive, even in the name of cultural, liberal sensitivities and tolerance, etc.
But they could do the same.
Can if they're the
well,
if
they have.
They can if they and they try and if you can if they are truly led to believe and come to the conclusion in their opinion that the certain practices are immoral, they will ban them.
Well, they do that in Switzerland. I think they ban Shchita because they feel that it's not.
That's right.
Humane.
There becomes a point in which every society will draw their line in the sand and say, we won't tolerate this practice if we believe it to be immoral. And that's true. And every society is entitled to draw the line in the sand where they want. It becomes the responsibility of the minority cultures within that community to defend and to support the position that their practices are not immoral, that are not morally offensive. Here, in the case of the Canaanites, they never go through that fact. They weren't thinking in those terms anyway. But there was nothing to defend. But that's the Ramban's understanding. So this V'karat Aleh L'Shalom opens up the door of a dialogue for peace together with all of the nations of Canaan. And if that's the case, you have to ask yourself the obvious question, which is, in the case of the Givonim, let's bring us back to Perek Tet, if this was the option, then
what did they do? do
right. Then why wouldn't they just do that? Why the ruse? Why the ruse? This question is asked explicitly by the Rambam. The Rambam, who also takes this position, that the Karat Aleh L'Shalom was an option for all the nations of Canaan, the Rambam takes it one step further. The Rambam suggests that the option of peace and or opening salvo of peace offer was applicable even to Amalek. And that's why we talked about this notion of the phrase "lo tachayek kol neshama" as not being literal, because if I take it literally, then I can't. Then it contradicts the notion that I have an option of okay, I surrender. If there's no option of okay, I surrender, then what does the peace offer represent? So the Rambam writes as follows: in source number 4, Rambam Machot Melachim, Perek Vav, Halacha Aleph. Ein osin mechama im adam ba'olam. Ad shekorin lo shalom. There is no, you cannot wage war with any person in the world, anybody, without exception, before first trying an offer of peace. Peace on certain terms, not peace at any price, but peace on certain terms. Echad mochemet harashut v'echad mochemet mitzvah, whether by obligatory mitzvah or obligatory war or optional war, as it says, "Ki tikrav al ir li lachem elev v'karat aleh l'shalom." That's the verse that we saw before. You first extend the peace. Im ishlimu v'kiblu sheva mitzvot shenitztavu bnei noach alehen. Here the Rambam says it explicitly. If they make peace and they accept the seven laws of Noach, en horgin mehen neshama v'hein lamas, then you can't touch them. Then they pay tribute, they pay taxes, they are part of your country. There he goes on in Halacha Bet and talks about various options. If you remember, there he talks about Amalek as well, and he extends this and he says explicitly this applies even to Amalek. In Halacha Gimel, v'asur l'shaker b'vritam u'lechazev lehem achar she'ishlimu v'kiblu sheva mitzvot. Another issue. Let's assume they make they agree to an acceptance of Sheva Mitzvot and Noach, and they come to terms with you, and they make a brit with you. You are prohibited from violating that brit. You are obligated to honor that brit. It's an interesting issue. By in and of itself, very important for us in the continuation of this story. Yes. But sometimes the obvious needs to be stated.
Surely they're giving up, they're making a brief, so you
then you have an obligation to abide by that brief. It's many a war have been fought over the lack of clarity over that point. So sometimes the clear and the obvious needs to be stated, because for some it's less clear and less obvious. Halacha hey. Shloshat now. Once we've established that that applies to all the Amei Canaan and Amalek, the Rambam goes one step further and he says, and this is a quote directly from the Yerushalmi, Shloshak tavim shalach Yeshua ad shelo nichnas la'aretz. Historically, this was exactly how Yehoshua conducted the conquest of Canaan. This is significant. This is fundamentally important because it essentially, the perception of the conquest of Canaan as it is written in Sefer Yehoshua is at odds with what the Rambam is about to write. Shloshak ktavim shalach Yeshua ad shelo nichnas la'aretz. Harishon shalach lahem. The first letter that he sent, pamphlets, leaflets, you know, like the IDF drops in. So he sent the IDF, got the idea from somewhere else. Right, they dropped them from airplanes. I'm not sure how Yeshua sent the letters, but Mi shirotze livroach yivrach. Option number one, get out. Leave. We're about to bomb your building. Leave. V'chazar v'shalach mitzvah shirotze lehashlim yashlim. Option two. Here are the terms of peace. You want to make peace? Not a problem. Here are the terms. Accept them. We will enter into a peace treaty. We will honor the peace treaty. It's very simple. Gergashi leaves. They go anywhere outside. what I call the zone. What's the zone? At the box of Eretz Canaan, which is essentially the seven, the area of the seven, of the tribal territory of the Shvatim, from the from essentially what is today southern Lebanon, from the Litani River south, to the northern part of the Negev.
Something was that realistic?
Sure. We've got all of the empire of the Hittites up here in Turkey, and you have all of Mesopotamia and the empire of Mesopotamia at the time, and you have all of Africa, Egypt and Kush, and lots of places to go. They don't want to live by the moral code of the Shevet Mitzvot Bnei Noach. Lots of places to go. I mean, if you zoomed out, you have the whole map of the Middle East. It's huge. Civilized, settled empires of the time included all of Mesopotamia, all of Africa, and all of the peninsula north, up through from northern Lebanon through Turkey, and Europe, that they knew about. What they knew about. I mean, there's also there's Asia and the Far East and etc., which is also settled, but they didn't know about them. Says the Rambam. Option one, Mishu etzel livrach yivrach. Option two, Mishu etzel lahashlim yashlim. Option three, v'chazar v'shalach. Mishu etzel lasot milchama yaseh. Anybody wants to make war, fine. You want to wage, you want to try your hand, think, isn't it? And with those three options, the conquest of Canaan begins. So what's the obvious question? So if the Givonim were on the receiving end of these letters, they knew that there were three options. They knew that option number one was to run away. They knew that option number two was to make peace with them, a brit. Even though it says lo tichrot lahem brit, even though it says hachorim tachorim, even though it says lo tachayakon neshama, even though they knew this, for some reason this they knew, but they didn't know what, that which was written in the letter they received that says that if you want to make peace, you can. Mister. We're making the assumption that we receive the letter, except that they seem to know what the command in the Torah was. They didn't receive a copy of the Torah. We didn't send out copies of the Bible and leave it in all the hotel rooms. They knew that, and they knew about. They knew enough. And if these were letters that were sent to all of the Amei Canaan, it's hard to imagine that they would have known that which was commanded to Moshe 40 plus years ago, but they wouldn't know what the letter that they receive now and that every nation in the Canaan received on the same terms. Girgashi certainly, according to tradition, knew they left.
But why did they leave? Why did the Givonim could have left also?
They could have left too. They had a better idea, in their opinion. But they could have left too. Leaving is not necessarily the easiest of options. And if they could figure out a way to bypass this whole system and stay, they'd prefer that. Plus, the advantage to them of having a brit with Israel is a brit of mutual defense. This brit is not just you'll let us alone and live peacefully, happily ever after. A brit is a dual agreement for mutual support and defense. That's what a brit means. A brit means if we're attacked, you'll come to our aid, and if we're attacked, you'll come to our aid. And that's exactly what will happen in Perek Yud. The war with the southern kingdom will begin because the Givonim are attacked by the king of Yerushalayim, and the Givonim send a letter to Israel and say, hey, you made a brit with us, now come and defend us. It's not just an arbitrary brit. It's a brit that has a price tag attached to it. Not just a function of let us live, it's a function of here's an equal, mutual, it's a NATO agreement. It's a NATO agreement. And that's what I think the Torah means when it says lo techot lahem brit. Lo techot lahem brit, if you think about the Rambam for a moment, this before if I just look at these verses or these mitzvot on the face of it, the Rambam seems to interpret these psukim one way, but run into a conflict with this pasuk on the other hand. In other words, what the Rambam is saying is that the mitzvah of Karat Aleh al-Shalom applies to the Amek Nan as well. The only distinction here is that this is a mechanism of how you campaign, not against whom you campaign. So the option for Amek Nan are two, either Shalom or Milchama. If it's Milchama, so then we have operational two mitzvot, Tachrim Tachrimim and Lo Techaye. Understand? What do I do with Lo Techot Lahem Brit? Prohibition against making a covenant. Is not Shalom a covenant? How does the Rambam address that issue? Let's hold that question for a moment. I think that's really the key issue here. Let's finish the Rambam. The Rambam raises this question of the Givonim himself, and he says, "Im kein, mipnima he'erimu yoshvei Givon." If it was such an easy option for them to simply say, "Okay, we'll make peace with you," then why do the Givonim have to go through this whole ruse? To which he answers, "Lefi sheshalach lehem bichlal v'lo kiblu." Because initially those letters were sent generically. They were sent to all the nations of Canaan. And their initial response was, we don't accept. Initially, when the first letters came to all the nations of Canaan, they came to Givon, and they came to Ai, and they came to Yericho, and they came to all the nations of Canaan. The initial response of the nations of Canaan were, what was their response? Did they pick up and leave? No, they stay. Did they make peace? No. So their initial response was war. We're going to fight these Israelites. We're not going to let them come into our territory. We're going to take them out. Then Yericho happened. Then Ai happened. Then the Brit then Shechem happened. And before you know it, now they have a problem. They completely underestimated who they were dealing with. V'lo yad'u mishpat Yisrael. They didn't understand the nuances of Israelite law. V'dimu sheshuv en patchin lehem l'shalom. They assumed that once they initially turned down the offer of peace, they no longer had an option. In other words, to their minds, they were still mistaken. In their minds, says the Rambam, they were still mistaken. They thought that the option of peace was no longer on the table. And therefore, they had to make this ruse that said, "Oh, we're from out of town." But if they had known that the option of peace was always on the table, even in the middle of war, the option of peace is on the table, says the Rambam. And that, this is so significant for the story with Amalek, because it tells me, and it's part of what we said earlier about the notion of the Battle of Canaan and the Battle of Amalek not being a battle of genocide. But at any point in the campaign, they can pick up a white flag and say, "We accept your terms," and that's the end of the campaign, says the Rambam. He says it explicitly. The only problem was that the Givonim did not know that they had that option. They did not know that they could make peace at any time. And so they thought that once they had initially rejected that offer of peace, then it was off the table and there were no longer an option other than to disguise themselves as foreigners.
Is this just a very different way of waiting the way that the Jews did it? Was this something that they weren't familiar with, this kind of
I don't know. Option? That's an interesting question.
It seems like something that they weren't, you know, this was so different to them, that the way they...
That's an interesting question. It probably was different.
What nations would know that you could make peace whenever you want?
Who asks? Who goes on?
How do you know that?
Right. Only we ask. Only we offer.
What is wrong?
In the middle of the campaign, right? In the middle of the campaign. That's the irony of it. In the middle of the campaign, you can still make peace.
Doesn't it sound like very familiar to now?
That's right. That's right.
Isn't that like chickening out? You already know you're losing, so let's just back out.
Okay. And we'll, and what will we do if they decide to chicken out?
We'll be the winners.
We'll take their offer and we'll accept. We'll sign that peace treaty and we'll move forward.
Mm-hmm. Won't last.
Right? But, and that's the power of it. So the Kifonim had this perfect out, and that's the tragedy of the story. Almost. Then he goes on and he writes the following: V'lama kasher davar l'nesiim. So if that's the case, if the Kifonim really could always make peace. And they made peace. So they tricked us. So they said, okay, we're from, we're out of towners. But essentially, they were doing what the Torah allows them to do, which is to make peace with the local inhabitants. There's nothing wrong with it. So, lama kashat davar l'nesiim. So, why did the Nesiim find this such a difficult task? And why did the people want to kill them? And why did, was Yeshua so angry at them? The Nesiim say themselves that if it weren't not for the oath that they took, these Givonim would be guilty of treason and they should be put to death. Why? Because they made a brit with them. And the Torah says you can't make a brit.
There's something different between making a brit and
right. Right. That's the key. There's a difference between lot lechot lehem brit.
Maybe because the brit is something you can't break, but they can break their peace.
That's a possibility. Brit is much more significant. Well, there's another possibility to come back to in a moment. Elahayadinam sheyu lemas avadim. The rule of shalom is if they accept the rule of the offer of peace, what's the Torah's, what does the Torah say? Vayula chalemas
va'avaducha.
They will pay tax and tribute and they will serve you. V'ho'il ubita'ut nishpu'u lehem bedin haya shi'hargu al shahit'um l'lechilu l'ashem. Come back to that last line a little bit later, perhaps next week, that they really had every justification to annul that brit and to kill them because they were taken under false pretense, but because of the Chilul Hashem factor, they decided to honor the brit. We'll come
but
back
they
to
did
the.
Pay taxes and they did circle.
Right. But we'll come back to the Chilul Hashem factor.
But you're saying the brit is much stronger than the shalom.
Correct.
The shalom, ideologically, for that those countries, giving up their Avodah Zarah was a very basic. I mean, when you do the shalom and you say it's mas and babadecha, they have to accept that there are no more idolatry. Isn't that what you said?
They do. Shavu mitzvot b'ninach, absolutely.
But that's a major, it's not such a simple thing either.
Correct.
For them.
But there's a fundamental difference between this and this.
And what is, well, what is,
that's
what makes a difference?
What's
in the
priest,
do they have to give up their idolatry?
Yes.
Okay, so then that, okay.
I think so. If they're staying in the local area, they have to give up their idolatry. I would imagine.
Well, a brit, are they making on God's name?
Well, they took a shvua with God's name.
And with the shalom, they're probably not.
So let me erase a lot of this so that it's less confusing to us. Right? And I think we'll begin to understand the difference between them. How does everybody
know this? How does who
know what?
It's not like their newspapers where you can read the newspaper.
What the Givonim know, I don't know. My issue is what the Bnei Yisrael knew.
Right. I mean, it's not just, it's everybody.
It works well.
So it says that I know we have two categories here. Brit and Shalom. What's the difference? We know what shalom requires. At least we do in the biblical arena. I'm not sure we know what shalom requires today, but we certainly know what it requires in the biblical arena. It requires several things. The Torah describes it as mas
va'avaducha.
The Rambam adds the criteria of Sheva Mitzvot Bnei Noach, because we are creating a, and this is a phrase that I like to use, an idolatry-free zone in Noach. The box is an idolatry-free zone. The box. You want to stay here? Here are your terms. Mas vavaducha, sheva mitzvot bnei noach, idolatry free zone. Jewish. Sovereignty. It's not a good sign. Jewish sovereignty. That's what Mas Vavaducha means. You pay taxes to the Israelites. You serve the Israelites. That's what Jewish sovereignty means. You become citizens of the land, the state of Israel, or the Malchut, the kingdom of Israel. That is not a brit. This is for, specifically for which people? But specifically, the chiddush here is that it's for Sheva. Who's a brit for? Is the brit option available to the seven nations? No. So the Rambam says explicitly no. The shalom option is not the brit option. What's the difference? What's a brit?
The brit maybe is what you can do with the kingdoms outside of Israel.
Right. Why? What is a brit?
It's a covenant.
It's an agreement. Oh, key word.
It's like an alliance.
Key word.
Isn't it like an alliance?
Alliance. One L or two?
Two. A-L-L-I-A-N-C.
A brit. Two words, you put them together, you get exactly what a brit is. It's a mutual alliance. It says, in a brit, and this is exactly how the Givonim understand it, I will defend you if you will defend me. Who makes a brit?
Two strong equal nations.
Two equal nations. They don't necessarily have to be strong, or equally of equal strength. The NATO alliance, there's a lot of nations that are not of equal strength, but they all share equal status. So two equal nations. Do I need to accept sovereignty to make a brit? No. On the contrary, you don't need a brit for nation, for citizens within your land. For citizens who live within your territory and accept your sovereignty, the issue isn't brit, the issue is shalom. Loyalty. Brit you make between nations. Israel and Jordan have a brit.
Right, you wouldn't want to have a brit with people within your own nation because then they're acting in their own sovereignty.
Correct. You make a brit with somebody, you grant them separate entity sovereignty. That's essentially what they're trying to do between Israel and the Palestinians. They're trying to create a brit with the Palestinians, not shalom.
And maybe that's what the Givonim wanted too originally.
And that's exactly what the Givonim want. We know that that's what they want because that's what they ask for. They ask for a brit, the brit is made, and in chapter 10, when they come under attack, the first thing they do is they turn to Israel and they say, come and defend us. There's no question that that's what they asked for. So that's what the Rambam, and they got it. That's exactly what they got.
To an extent.
Because at the end, when they discovered that they're local, so they can't annul the whole thing, they can't kill them, and they transform it from a brit into a shalom.
But they still don't go and capture capture Yerushalayim, which it is giving them freedom and sovereignty over that.
They haven't captured Yerushalayim. Why is Yerushalayim relevant?
They were learning Shmuel Bet, and we learned that David had to go and do it.
Yeah, he does. No, nobody goes to Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim's a non-entity.
Right, so that in one of the Mefarshim, it said that it was, you know, it was the Chivi, I guess it was, but they associated them with the Divani. I don't remember exactly.
They don't go to Yerushalayim for many reasons. They don't go to Yerushalayim for generations. They don't go to Yerushalayim.
And it's not because of this?
No, I don't think it has anything to do with this. The Givonim have nothing to do with Yerushalayim. On the contrary, Yerushalayim is one of the cities that attacks the Givonim. And Israel, in defending the Givonim, conquers Yerushalayim, and then they give it up again.
Because
they can't be bothered with it. It happens more than once in Yeshua and Shoftim. It happens at least twice, if not three times. They get to Yerushalayim and they move on. But we'll talk about that when we start Sefer Shoftim. But you understand the difference between a brit and shalom. This is the critical piece for this parak. What they ask for is a brit, says the Rambam. And that wasn't allowed. What the Torah allowed for was shalom. If they wanted shalom, they had an option for it. They always had an option for it. Whether they knew or understood that they had that option or not is unclear, but once the breach was established, then they've moved into a different category or a different level. And now the question is, do you honor such a breach? The Rambam says you have no choice but to honor such a breach, even if it was made under false pretense, you have no choice but to honor it. We'll come back to that issue, Bezrat Hashem, in our next unit. I'm not finished. I just wanted to finish this piece. Questions on this? Now, I have a couple of loose ends I want to finish up with, but I just wanted to know. Any questions on this? So it gives us at least an understanding of what their motivation is, who's doing what, why are they engaged in such a ruse, and how they perpetrate this ruse against Israel.
What happens with Amalek?
Amalek is not part of this discussion. At all. I just mentioned Amalek because it's 2 weeks before Purim. But Amalek also has an option of shalom. The notion that Amalek is this genocidal command to wipe out every man, woman, and child of Amalek, see them on the street and shoot them first is a myth. And then I'm not sure it's a myth that does us any good. Reputation-wise, I'm not sure it's a myth that does us any good. We have enough trouble with the laws that are on the books. Why, you know, laws that are mythical? It just, more
from it. If we kind of like blew this up and kind of, you know, made it our mantra, I mean, it would really help our image. Israel suffers from this all the time.
Years ago, there was a. I must have mentioned this. There was a. effort put forward in the Knesset by, I can't remember if it was led by Yossi Sarid or Shulamit Aloni, but it was one of them. There was a bill put forward in the Knesset to restructure the biblical canon and remove Sefer Yehoshua from the Bible because it is genocidal and immoral. And it's hate literature, and it should be banned on the basis of hate literature. Only in the Knesset. Anyway, it didn't go very far, needless to say. It's always fascinating. It's always fascinating to me where we have come from and where we have gone. It is known that David Ben-Gurion had a copy of the Tanakh, and particularly Sefer Yehoshua, on his desk always. And he built the strategic battle plan for the defense of Israel around Sefer Yehoshua. That's a well-known story. And somewhere in the early or the mid-80s, there was this campaign in the Knesset to ban the study of and reading of Sefer Yehoshua on the basis of hate literature and genocidal warmongering. Anyway, at that point, there was an outcry in Israel, and the Tanakh centers, particularly the Gush, in the Herzog Institute of the Bush, organized a day of learning, a Yom Iyun, specifically on Sefer Yehoshua and on the question of the morality of Sefer Yehoshua. And they published a journal of all of the lectures given that day. It's called Musar Mechama V'Kibush. I have a copy of it. And it's a series of articles by Ryan Lichtenstein, by Yoel Ben-Nun, by Yehoshua Meidan, by all of the big names in Tanakh, specifically about this issue of the morality of Sefer Yehoshua. It's very misunderstood. And there's...
So this is just Rambam's point of view.
But this is the halacha. This is the normative point of view. In other words, Rashi's interpretation of the Chumash is one thing. Part of the reason why we are biased in our understanding of the issues is because we are biased in our understanding of Chumash because we read it through the eyes of Rashi. And we do that from the time we're young. Rashi is not always normative. Rashi is very easy to understand in terms of the perish of the psukim, because this is much harder to see in the pshat of the parak. But halacha doesn't always reflect the pshat of the text. There are many places that where the halacha veers from the pshat, and we're bound normatively by the halachic principles. The fundamental difference between where we are coming from and where others come from is that others take the text and that's all they have, and then they read the text and they derive whatever conclusions they come from it. Whereas we have a Torah Shebaal Peh. So the halachic norm allows us to a certain breadth that if I'm limited to the text itself, I don't have. Last week, Parshat Mishpatim is a classic example where Chazal clearly understood certain fundamentals like Ayin Tachad Ayin to be figurative or to be philosophical and not literal. Many other societies understood it literally, including societies that operate today in certain parts of the world. And we, but because we have the breadth of a Torah Shebaal Peh, we can understand Torah in a much broader sense. But thus you can't separate Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebaal Peh. If you do that, you've crossed a line that dare not be crossed. So the Rashi can interpret the pasuk according to the pshat, but even Rashi will tell you that doesn't necessarily mean that that's normative halacha. Normative halacha comes from the Gemara, and the Gemara's conclusion is exactly as the Rambam's conclusion is, which is that the option of a karat aleh l'shalom applies in all circumstances, at all times, even to Amalek, within certain terms.
Did they ever go into the reasoning why the Gershani ran away as opposed to taking one of these choices?
Well, or I mean, the logic of Girgashi running away instead of taking this choice is because they didn't want to give up their idolatry and they didn't want to fight. So the option is to go live your idolatrous life somewhere else.
Was that cut and dry?
The idolatry-free zone is in the land of Canaan only.
But it doesn't really last. I mean, they continue.
That's our problem, not the mitzvah's problem. In other words, the Torah's ideal was that we would go and conquer the entire land and create that idolatry-free zone and culture, as Yeshayahu describes it, as an Or LaGoyim. And what ended up happening was, if you can see from the orange, let me bring it back here because otherwise I won't be on tape. If you see from the orange, by the end of the conquest of Sefer Yehoshua, we have conquered only a very small portion of the land of Canaan. So in that mission we failed. But that's really a subject for discussion in the second half of, or the latter part of Sefer Yehoshua. The conclusion is that we fail in that mission. But the goal here was, this is your box. Any nation who wants to live here has to abide by Sheva Mitzvot Pnenach. Girgashi chose to leave, I assume, because they didn't want to have to live by that moral limitation or theological limitation. All right, I have 5 minutes left. I just want to show. I just want to address one last nuanced detail, unrelated. Put it as a postscript to the rest of this discussion. Next week we'll pick up the what I think is from a textual point of view, the most fascinating part of this story, which is the leadership issues. Who's saying what to whom? How many leaders do the Jewish people have at this point in time? That's from a completely unrelated to the Givonim. There's a fascinating internal dynamic issue in this parak over the nature of Bnei Israel and what's happening here in the aftermath of Ai, which is fascinating in and of itself. But before I do that, one phrase I want to just address, and we'll do it quickly because it won't take us more than a moment, and that is the opening phrase of Pasuk Dalet, Perek Tet, Pasuk Dalet. Yoshvei Givon Shemuot Asher Asai Yehoshua LeYericho VeLa'ai. The inhabitants of Givon heard what Yeshua had done to Yericho and Ai. Vayasu Gam Hema BeOrma. Vayalchu VaYitzdayam. Yeshua Perek Tet. Perek Tet. This whole sugi is in Perek Tet. Pasuk Dal. Vayasu Gam Hema BeOrma. They also acted with guile or deceit. What's the problem with this verse? Textually, what's the issue? The Givonim heard what Yeshua had done to the people of Yericho and Ai, and they also acted with deceit.
Why is it also?
What's the Gam doing? I mean, they also acted with deceit and guile. Who acted with deceit and guile before them? Fair question? They also acted with deceit. They heard everything that Yeshua did to Yericho and Ai, and they also responded with deceit and blah, 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 blah.
Are they referring to Israel?
I don't know who they're referring to, but that's the question.
Because they took
So here the Mefarshim offer three different options. One's way out in left field. It's fascinating, but it's out in left field. And it's the fact that they are, that this people of Givon come from the nation of Chivi. And the Chivi, the Chivi is a fascinating story. Chivi takes us all the way back to the story of Yaakov. Supposedly the inhabitants of Shechem are of Chivi nationality. So Rashi and Radak suggest, and you see it in source number 5, Yasu Gam Hema Be'orma. What's the Gam Hema? Kemo Shasu Bnei Yaakov Be'orma U'B'chamor Avi Shechem She'ya Chivi. Chamor Avi Shechem was also Chivi. So who's the also? Not only did Bnei Yaakov act with guile and deceit when they tricked Chamor Avi Shechem and the inhabitants of Shechem into circumcising all of their children when they wanted to explicate Dinah from their grasp, but they also acted with deceit and disguised themselves, etc., etc., etc. Very creative, very powerful. What on earth is the story of Yaakov's children and Shechem doing in the story of Givon?
Because it's like
divine
retribution.
Maybe. Fine. Mind retribution over thousands of hundreds of years later, the Givonim come to take revenge on the fact that Yaakov's children beguiled the inhabitants of Shechem. Possible. I'll buy it, maybe. Put it in the back burner. Option one. Source number 6 is the Radak. Radak offers two additional possibilities. Possibility number one, Gam Lerabot Bnei Yericho Va'ai. Actually, let's start from possibility number 3. Yesh Tefresh Od Gam Lerabot Al Ormat Yisrael Lefi Machshevet HaChivi. In other words, says the Radak, it could be that what it means is that the Givonim thought that Israel must have tricked Yericho and Ai. in some way, because they obviously conquered them, and they couldn't conquer Yericho and Ai without some sort of guile or trickery. So clearly Israel must be guilty of some kind of trickery. We are going to respond in kind. So there, that gam would be on Bnei Yisrael, but not real trickery, but their perspective, the way they under perception of what happened. I find the most fascinating is the middle interpretation. Is referring to Bnei Yericho and Ai. But, he says, Ki hem asu im Bnei Yisrael lihishamer mehem. They also acted in the way for self-protection and self-preservation. They fought back. As it says, Yericho segeretum segeret, Yericho was enclosed, Yericho was trying to protect itself with the wall, or to wage war with them, as I did. Vehem asu gam hem came. They also protected themselves. Aval be'orma. But with God. In other words, the difference between the way the Radak reads this verse in Rashi is Rashi reads it as they also acted deceitfully. And then I have to figure out who also acted deceitfully. The way the Radak reads it is they also acted, comma. Vayasu gam hema, comma. I protected themselves. Yericho protected themselves. Vayasu gam hema, they also did something for their own protection. Aval, unlike Yericho and I, who simply acted in self-defense by either waging war in self-defense or trying to close themselves into the wall, they acted deceitfully by bringing about this ruse. So it's all in where you put the comma. Vayasu gam hema. They also acted. Yorma. It's all where you put the comma. And that is one of the classic examples of biblical interpretation, exegesis, parshanut. Rashi had completely different interpretations, all because they put the comma. Is it Vayasu gam hema be'orma, or is it Vayasu gam hema be'orma? We will conclude.